Want to drive greater success in social commerce? With Deloitte's latest creator economy research, you can. After surveying over 500 creators and 500 brands, our insights are helping CMOs and marketing teams harness the power of content creators. And not only that, but how to do it well. See for yourself by visiting cmo.deloitte.com today.
If you think back, what's the first brand in your life as a young girl that made an impact on you?
Love's Baby Soft. Love's Baby Soft was a perfume that you got when you were like 9. And it was that rite of passage, you know, and it smelled like baby powder. Sense of smell memory is really powerful. I used to say that at J&J, like baby powder. J&J is the only brand that has a smell, the only corporate equity that has a smell. Well, Love's Baby Soft smells like baby powder. And it was in my stocking probably when I was 8 years old. And I think I had that little bottle of perfume, you know, until I went to college.
Hi, I'm Jim Stengel, and I help major brands find their purpose and activate it, and the profits follow. For 7 years, I was the global marketing officer for Procter & Gamble, where I oversaw the marketing of hundreds of brands. You may not know it, but the CMOs, the chief marketing officers of all of your favorite brands, are trying to connect you with your favorite products and services through purpose. And on this show, I delve into how they do it. My guest today on the CMO podcast is Alexandra von Plato, the first ever woman CEO of Publicis Health, the parent company of 15 healthcare marketing agencies like Digitas Health and Saatchi & Saatchi Wellness. Publicis Health is a giant in its field. It has 3,000 employees and 40 offices worldwide and is part of the Publicis Group, the French multinational marketing and communications holding company. And for insights into today's top leaders in healthcare, my guest Alex has seen more healthcare CMOs and CEOs in action than almost anyone. Alex and I first met on stage at the Cannes Lions Health event in the summer of 2014, when we collaborated on a keynote speech about purpose and the incredible opportunity for more creativity and engagement in healthcare marketing and advertising. And since then, Alex was promoted to CEO in 2018, and besides being a great CEO, she is a mom of 3 kids and a very active presence in the community in Philadelphia. This is my conversation with Alex von Plato. Welcome, Alex, to the CMO podcast. We are recording this in the holiday season, and we're heading into 2021, of course. So I want to start with, what are you looking forward to in the holiday season this year? And what are you looking forward to in 2021?
Well, you know, I've had a wonderful time working from home, you know, getting reacquainted with the domestic rhythm in my family's life. And it's really been a silver lining. I've spent most of my life, you know, on the road and rushing from one country or one city to the other on planes, trains, and automobiles. So although I have been at home, Jim, I haven't really been present. And so it's been sort of this odd thing because I'm here and I'm usually not here, but somehow I'm still not fully here because I'm often on calls and in meetings, and it's been very wall to wall. We've been really busy. So what I'm looking forward to is being home and being present. And, you know, oddly too, my kids, I have a 26-year-old who actually, you know, lives on his own now, and 2 teenage daughters, and they're sort of captive now, you know, so I'm going to be spending time with them, you know, I'll be present, and they won't really have that many places to go, which is unusual because they're always trying to escape. So I'm really looking forward to being cozy, honestly, and, you know, spending some time together and being grateful. You know, just being grateful for having each other and recognizing that so many people have been in so much pain and are actually, you know, living this holiday season with great grief and loss. And we'll be thinking about them and we'll be grateful for what we have.
That's a big word, grateful these days. I agree with you. I was on a CMO roundtable call last night and everyone talked about, it was very poignant, very talked about gratefulness. And this Thanksgiving, I think, is especially significant for so many people. And so that's one of the positives coming out of this. What your teenage daughters, what are they doing at home? How are they staying? I mean, school's virtual, right?
Yes, it was. They were doing a hybrid up until this week. And now they're back, you know, full time at home. So, you know, for a little moment there, I mean, teenagers never really super look forward to going to school, but they were happy to get back and get socialized and, you know, get out of the house. So now we're back all sort of sheltering in place here. And I have one daughter who's in the midst of applying for college. You know, it's a very surreal time to do that. I mean, she's looking forward to her independence and the next chapter of her life. And so much of that means moving out, moving away and having that big experience. So, you know, I think I see her trying to tamp down her own, you know, anticipation, because she's kind of steeled to be disappointed by not being able to go wherever she ends up, you know, choosing or being able to get accepted. So that's going on. So that's, you know, very, very bittersweet. But I would say, you know, bitter, because that time of life, you know, you need to get, this is the separation moment. That's so much about how your early adulthood forms. And, you know, I'm sad for these kids who aren't going to get that full swing. And my daughter, who's a junior, you know, she's, look, these kids were able to seamlessly, I mean, they didn't have to cut over to a virtual platform friendship. Like, they have full-fledged relationships through these platforms that they're very comfortable having. So it's not like they're missing out on connecting with people, but, you know, there's certainly a lot less parties.
Oh, maybe that's a good thing. So what about 2021? What are you looking forward to next year?
I mean, we, you know, from my family's standpoint, you know, we're just keeping everybody safe and keeping my parents, you know, safe and you know, hoping that sometime next year, and I hope, I don't anticipate it being much before the end of next year, but that we can look forward to, you know, truly being able to returning to some kind of normal, you know, pace of life and connection with the people we love and the colleagues we love and the business we do the way we do it. So I'm looking forward to that with the rest of the world. But I also am, I'm monitoring my own expectations there, because I know a little bit about how long it takes to commercialize these vaccines and these treatments and get them distributed. And I think we have, you know, a good potential year ahead of us before that promise comes to any kind of full fruition or even partial fruition that actually opens up our ability to function fully again. I'm also looking forward, though, to, you know, my team and my business has just performed so extraordinarily well under such difficult circumstances. And we've been under tremendous pressure. As you know, I work in, serve the primarily the pharmaceutical and healthcare industries. And our clients have really been under the gun and the spotlight and lots of all eyes on them. And it's put a lot of pressure on all of us and everybody who serves the industry. And I'm so grateful for the performance of my team. I feel like fortune favors the prepared, and we were just prepared to really, you know, absorb the shock here and, you know, turn it into business momentum. So I'm really looking forward to, you know, continuing the collaboration with, you know, my extraordinary team and our clients, because it's been remarkable and it's been uplifting, honestly. Sometimes I feel guilty about that, that we've gotten so much positive, you know, encouragement and so much traction under these circumstances.
Well, we're going to talk about a lot of that, you know, in the course of the next half hour or so. But I want to do something different on this podcast because you're an interesting guest and I know you. But I want to start with our kind of random round of questions that I usually do at the end of the podcast to get to know my guest a bit better as a person, as a leader. But I want to start with that. And the first question I have for you, Alex, is when you were young, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I thought I wanted to be a lawyer for, you know, when I was very small. And I then thought I wanted to be an actress. And I think that both those, how those professions were depicted to me largely through television media were very much performance driven. You know, the lawyer shows were about like being in court and making your case and like, you know, being persuasive and, you know, surprising people with some kind of, you know, amazing new fact that they hadn't thought of or couldn't have understood before you presented it. And, you know, acting too is like, it's performing. So I think that those were the things that made me excited about, you know, a work life. And I always thought that I would have a career. I never really thought about getting married, and I never thought about having kids until I was like well into my mid-30s.
What's the one thing that we could not find out about you on the internet?
I went to community college.
Really?
Yes. So, I started school I went to where the school I could afford to go to. Mm-hmm. And I started at community college. I worked full time straight through college, 40 hours a week. I've been working since I was about 14 years old. And I don't usually talk about that, Jim, because for a long, long time, I was very ashamed of it, you know, and I thought, people aren't going to respect me if they know that, you know, I don't have some prestigious degree. And so I haven't really put it out there very much. So you won't find it out, but everybody's going to know now.
So what did you do as a job during community college? What was your work, the 40 hours a week?
You know, I worked in restaurants mostly, but one of the things that I did was I was always pitching ideas for how to do a promotion with a local radio station or, you know, how to create like some new offer in the restaurant and how to redo the menu to make it more, you know, pick up on some trend that was happening. So, you know, I would go on radio shows in the local market and pitch our like Friday happy hour.
So at 15 years old,
I was always, by then I was in college, but like then I was always like, and I loved communications and I loved that part of, you know, I love media, you know, I really love media. I have an attention span for media because I have the attention span of a ferret. So I really love the idea of putting an idea out there in the world and having people react to it and see it. And, you know, that kind of pride of authorship moment was something that always really appealed to me. And even though I had restaurant jobs, I always had something going on the side.
So you're wired to be in the ad media business. When did that dawn on you?
In college, you know, I ended up transferring to Temple University and I took a communications major and I had an internship at a television station and then my friends started to be people who were in the media and advertising business. And, you know, my first job out of college was at QVC Network. It was 24/7 direct response TV. I think I was one of the early employees there. And I got to work with Joe Siegel, who was the founder. And, you know, the idea of a live show, even though it was just showing like Capodimonte porcelain, I was, you know, 22 years old. So It was, you had to be live every day, every minute of every day. And it was, you know, that to me was always something that I took a lot of energy from.
So you were a creative person for most of your career, and you're now a CEO. What was the largest adjustment going from thinking about the creative work every day to thinking about lots of other things as you do as a CEO?
You know, for me, it wasn't such a big segue because I approach my role as CEO as a storyteller, as more of the chief storyteller. And so what I learned how to do through my career, and I did start out in production. So some of my first jobs were producing. And so I got that feel of building an ensemble, hitting the ground running in the morning. There's nothing on the set. You know, at the end of the day, there's, you know, 32,000 feet of film in a can that you have to rush to the lab. And I was one of the kids who would drive to do art, you know. I did a lot of work for P&G, Jim. I worked on the Always campaign as a producer for years. It was DMB&B was your agency.
Sure.
And but in any event, that idea of like getting a group of people with great craft, great craft ethics, you know, and great commitment to making the show, you know, it's the show's the thing when you're, you know, on location at 4 o'clock in the morning and it's raining, you know. So doing that and then, you know, taking that ensemble idea to the creative department and building creative teams that were about the craft lines and really the dignity of all the different disciplines and loving people for how committed they were to typography, you know, or to mute sound design or to, you know, all the nuances,
the craft.
And anyway, so I took all that with me, you know, straight through my career is that I want to build a team. I want to have an ensemble. I want to have a team that feels dignity in their work. And I want them to have a sense of the story that we're all writing together. You know, the narrative arc of the business really matters to me, you know, and I love that. So I make that principle to the way I conduct myself as a CEO, and hopefully, you know, it's having a good impact on our team and our business. But I couldn't unlearn that stuff. And I had to pick up other things on the way in my bag of tricks, like, you know, financial acumen and, you know, personnel management and HR and, you know, competitive environment monitoring and all of that stuff. And it, you know, I have a great team around me too, so I don't have to be an expert in everything. That's the other secret of CEOs, right? Is that you don't really have to be the principal architect of every aspect of the business. You can let things go to the people who can really own that expertise.
What's the toughest decision you've had to make in your career?
You know, I think that's such a great question. I mean, I've had to, the tough decisions are when you have to cut something, you know, and certainly letting people go and, you know, any kind of reduction in force, you know, is very gut-wrenching. I've closed entire businesses down, taken agencies like out of business, multiple times, you know, deciding to, you know, focus on the strategy and understanding that, you know, you need that foundation of the business strategy and you're building that in the marketplace. And sometimes you have to make very tough decisions that impact people and impact legacies. And I think for, you know, very many people are in the front line of having to make those decisions, they can be very difficult. And, you know, I always say when we go through anything convulsive like that, that the list that you're making is the list of the people and organizations that are going to be part of the future. It's what makes it you know, a powerful business exercise and experience for an individual who has to make tough calls is if what you're doing is you're focusing on the future and putting the business in a better situation to thrive in the future. So therefore, everybody who is remaining with the business was actually on the primary list, the list of the people you want to stay. And I often, you know, find myself whenever we've had to do something like that. Unfortunately, in my career, it's been very few times, but that's really the story. It's like the group of people you're looking at the end of a terrible exercise like that is the group of people who, you know, you're banking on to carry us forward. And that's the little bit of silver lining in what is otherwise, you know, nothing that anybody ever would want to do.
That's a positive way to think about it. Tell me about the most resilient moment in your career when you had to bounce back from something.
You know, I've had a couple where, you know, there was business downturn, you know, tremendous business downturn. And the business had to go through one of those cathartic moments. And, you know, everybody's looking at leadership as with skepticism, you know, with sometimes with real doubt and sometimes with hostility, you know, and when you know you're working so hard and you believe that, you know, you're making principled decisions, but you feel this doubt and you feel this, you know, disconnection, you really have to dust yourself off and try and go back out there and win the hearts and minds again, because you lost them, you know, you lost them somewhere. And if you're a person who indexes a little bit on the emotional, you know, interpersonal connection side of the business, which I do, that can be very painful. You know, the sense that your own team doesn't trust you anymore, or you might have lost their trust. And I always say that in business, and I think in life, trust is currency, and we're all responsible for earning it. It's nothing that anybody owes you. It's something that accrues to you through your behaviors and what you demonstrate in the world. And I really believe that, and I try and operate that way. I'm sure I fail sometimes, but it's when I feel like I've lost the trust is when I feel the most wounded. And it's like, you know, kind of trying to get yourself to be resilient enough and get some scar tissue over that and lean back into your true north and be the best person you can be and prove to people that you can earn that trust back somehow.
That CMO meeting I had last night, we talked an awful lot about trust. It's the foundation for everything. And you're right. It has to be earned day in and day out, minute by minute. I did a recent podcast with the Butterball Turkey. You know, we're in the holiday season. Their CMO, all he talked about was trust. Trust with the farmers. Trust with the people who make the food for the farmers. Trust with the retailers. Trust with consumers. He said, we're in the food business. We're putting things on people's plate. It's all based on trust.
Yep. Absolutely. And I think it's we're at a moment now where you can say that and you can and it has the full power of credibility behind it. It's not an empty thing. Like throwing the word trust around is actually dangerous. It actually hollows it out. But for the people who are really trying to build that kind of equity and know that it has to be substantial, I think the world is their oyster because, you know, when you're sincere about it and you actually understand some of the mechanisms that drive it, you know, the world of business and the world at large needs that now more than ever. And I'm really heartened to hear that so many senior executives and so many companies are taking it on board, not just to have a talking point, but to actually to live it, to make it part of their fundamental value system. And I think, you know, I know I came across you, Jim, in a part of my career when I was very much full of this, you know, aspiration to make purpose real and a real driver of business. And there were a lot of people who were telling me that it was just hyperbolic and it wasn't a thing. And, you know, that's the kind of thing women talk about, you know, and I felt, you know, self-conscious about that. And when I came across you and you had just, you know, written Grow, and I felt like, oh my God, you know, here's somebody with this incredible credibility who's basically giving me the rocket fuel to make this real in my own life and in my business. And so much about purpose is about trust, because it's about authenticity.
What would you say is the key to success for today's CMO? If you said data, you wouldn't be the only one. At Deloitte, however, we believe data is only half of the equation. The other half, story. Because data is the language of business, but story is the language of humans. And we believe the most successful CMOs know how to harness the power of both data and story. To learn more about Deloitte's CMO program and how we can help today's CMOs succeed, visit cmo.deloitte.com. Hey, what are you interested and excited to talk about for the rest of this podcast?
Well, you know, clearly science is on everybody's mind. And I just love saying that out loud. The nobility of it, the sacrifice of it, the miracle of it, you know, what it takes. Not all those things are understood, but I think we have an aperture at this moment in time to tell an essential narrative about the role of science in general, the role of medicine, you know, particularly. I think we've taken a lot of it for granted. We've looked at it as a cost and not an investment. You know, we invest in our military. We know what the expense of it is, but we think of it as an investment. But healthcare is a cost. And healthcare creates health. So, you know, I work primarily, my clients are in the pharmaceutical industry, and, you know, they've had such a tough road from a reputational standpoint. I mean, they're the most, you know, mistrusted, misunderstood industry, or at least they're like on the lowest end of the list. I don't know what's lower than the pharmaceutical industry. It's like between like big tobacco and the pharmaceutical industry. One time I went to the New York Times for some editorial meeting with their editors, and one of their beat editors came in and said, I cover, here's the beats I cover: tobacco, firearms, and pharma.
Ooh.
And I was like, how could that be a beat? Tobacco kills people, firearms kill people, and pharma makes medicine for sick people. Like, he's like, oh, those are just the industries everybody loves to hate. And then he said, don't worry about it, Alex, for much longer, because food is right on your heels. Like, the food industry is going to be the next hated industry. So
that's
anyway.
Pressure. Yeah, well, let's talk about that a bit. You know, you're the CEO of this big company that works for all of these incredible healthcare clients. And I went to your website, of course, in preparation for this, and I did my research on you and the company. And the first thing I see when I go to your website is this bold headline: The Power of One Purpose, to create a world where people are equipped and motivated to take control of their own health. Could you talk about that, the origin of it, how it plays out in your work, how it plays out with your team? How does it play out with your clients? Do all your clients believe in that? So tell us a bit about that opening statement on your website.
Yeah. So it's not enough to just be aware of something, you know, in health. You have to actually engage. You actually have to do something behaviorally. And any medication on its surface is complete mystery to even a doctor. I mean, you can't tell what a pill does by looking at it. You know, a pill is like a molecule surrounded by information and engagement. So when we say people have to be motivated, they have to be able to see what's in it for them. They really need to be, it's a very heavy lift to get people honestly to take better care of themselves. And so the powers of persuasion and motivation as it relates to healthcare are very extreme and the bar is very high. And then on top of that, they have to be equipped. They have to be informed. They have to have insurance coverage. They have to know where the doctor is. They have to know how to have a conversation. They have to understand what happened in the conversation. They have to follow the instructions. They have to modify their lifestyle. They have to be equipped. Because when they're actually motivated and equipped, they will get, if you are, you will get a better outcome in your life. You will receive the full benefit of, if your treatment is a medication, of the medication, if you're fully understanding, or you're more fully understanding of, you know, why you need it, why you should take it, how you should take it, what you should change in order for you to get the best outcome. And our job is to really do both those things, motivate and equip people and keep them, or get them and keep them engaged in their own health and in their own care. And so I think pharmaceutical marketing is really about healthcare engagement. They're the engagement. They make the medicine, but then they also have to create the framework to maximize the engagement around the proper, you know, diagnosis and distribution and experience around the treatment. So for my team, we had a mantra early on in one of the agencies I founded, which was called Digitas Health. It was based on the Digitas model, but we brought it to healthcare. And we had a little mantra. It was called helping, not selling. And everybody hated it because they were like, you can't tell our clients not to sell. And really, it was based on being a digital native, you know, person and being in digital media for many years and knowing that when people are in digital platforms, they basically they want something, they're looking for something, they want some value immediately or they're out of there. You know, there's no tax, there's no passive consumption. It's all it's called interactive because it's active. And so I said, you gotta understand what people are looking for, because nobody's really shopping for, you know, for a beta blocker or for, you know, cholesterol lowering medicine. They're shopping for something. They're looking around for information because they either have a pain, have a worry, got a diagnosis, or having a problem with something that's going on with them. So this sense of like urgency and need has to be really understood, you know, and we have to meet them where they need us. So this idea of help them solve their problem on their own behalf, that's marketing in healthcare. It's really a much more service driven and what we're seeing is much more customer service driven than a lot of other product categories, because you don't have desire. The desire is out of anxiety. You know, it's a negative desire. So you can't entertain people too much about it. It's not that you can't be entertaining. You can even be funny, but you have to be cognizant of the quest that they're on and what's motivating them and animating it.
This is a big remit for an advertising/communications company as you are. I want you to talk about that in light of your clients. You know, you have a window into the CEOs and CMOs of healthcare companies better than most people. So with that remit you just talked about of, you know, equipping, motivating, changing behavior, engaging. What is the greatest strength you feel the healthcare industry has to leverage to that end? And what is their largest challenge or barrier?
Well, the greatest, you know, asset they have is they have the power of science and scientific discovery. These are this is the highest tech industry in the world. These are, you know, scientific research that can find a needle in a haystack and pull it out and have, you know, a treatment for cancer that, you know, allows people to live longer and healthier lives in the face of something that would have been a death sentence. I mean, one of my clients is Gilead. And what's happened to HIV in my lifetime? You know, it was an absolute death sentence. It was the pandemic. It was the pandemic that the country never absorbed because it was not happening to everybody. But the people it happened to at the time died. It wasn't like 2% of them died. It was most of them died. And now HIV, for many doctors, they rather see a patient with HIV than diabetes because of the therapies have come so far. So I guess, you know, I go back to the narrative, what they actually do and the value they actually create in the world and in humanity is their greatest asset. One of the issues is that's been obfuscated. And the origins narrative of these companies has been lost. And some of it's been lost because we've rushed to adopt advertising values, you know, that are mostly about awareness making. And we haven't balanced it with the experience side of, you know, really deeply educating, and I'm talking about on the consumer side, because certainly that's been done on the professional side. But even on the professional side, you know, for a while, I feel like we lost our way a bit because physicians were kind of treated as a distribution platform, mm-hmm. you know, and not a partner in care. And I do think that in the C-suite, there's lots of recognition of that. And there's a desire to make sure that those dots get connected in a way that really allow the breakthrough science of these companies to make the impact that they should and can be making to a broader population, you know, and understanding that we sometimes get in our own way.
What have you done to address that barrier, or that sort of it's not a service or an experience mindset, it's a bit more of a communications mindset? And is there, it's a tricky question, is there a client that you think is a beacon for this, that's paving the way, that's setting a standard, someone that you work with that you think is especially inspiring and showing us the new way to think about healthcare engagement and motivation and equipping people with the right knowledge, skills, so that they want to do the right thing for themselves?
I think a lot of our clients are, because I think, you know, I like to think that's why they hire us, because they recognize that that's something that, you know, they themselves are prioritizing. I think that the clients that have built out patient services as part of their, it's part of their, you know, doing business, you know, and recognize that the healthcare system is often, you know, complex for people to navigate, and to create an opportunity to pick up the phone and call somebody and have them explain something to you or answer a question, or having a digital, you know, response mechanism. The whole idea of being responsive and being on demand is coming to the fore, both on the patient and physician side. I mean, on the physician side, there was always the sales force, which was obviously very customer focused. But, you know, it was a person calling on a doctor in their office, and the doctor needed to make time for when that person showed up. So these on-demand kind of systems and platforms that allow for a customer service experience that's really pleasant and, you know, really relevant. I think we have a lot of the industry looking at investing in those platforms, and you know, that's a little bit of technology. That's a lot about technology, a lot about data, and a lot about content, which, you know, we feel we've been very purposefully building over the last decade with the acquisitions Publicis Group has made and with the solutions that we've been developing. And again, I'll go back to Gilead just as a case in point. You know, Gilead and HIV, I mean, one of the things that they are very devoted to is the community and very grassroots connections with community healthcare providers, and especially in pockets of the community where HIV is still an epidemic, where there's stigma around the diagnosis, and that people don't want to get tested because there's shame associated with a positive HIV test. And, you know, how Gilead has gotten right up alongside of the providers in these communities to, you know, bring solutions down at the, you know, grassroots level. And they do it as part of, you know, corporate responsibility, but they do it as part of the way they go to market. And everything we do for them has that in the forefront. I mean, we did a campaign called Healthy Sexual, and it was really about, you know, your sex. I mean, this is a pharmaceutical company saying your sexuality is a healthy part of your life. And you should celebrate your sexuality, and you should have a full life. And there's a way to do that and protect yourself and the people you love at the same time from HIV. You know, and I thought that was such a generous and generative, to quote my friend Craig Douglas, that was such a generous idea, you know, that you could celebrate sexuality and marry it with health, and you know, do that as a pharmaceutical company. It's brave, and it's true, and it was needed, and it helped create a platform for so many communications because it broke down people's resistance too. It's like, what do you mean healthy sexual?
What did it take? Has Gilead always been like this, or what did it take to turn in that organization? What was it? Was it a leader? Was it a massive effort to understand their patients, their audience better, their community better? What was it?
I mean, we've been working with them, it's been close to 10 years, if not 10 years, through many of their evolution of their armamentaria in HIV. And I feel like the spirit was always there. There was, you know, to tell a really specific story, a friend of mine who I knew from my career previously went to work there and called us, you know, about a decade ago. And, you know, he really felt that there was an opportunity to bring this kind of grassroots feeling to the fore. And we worked for a long, long time to give him the ammunition, you know, to make the case through many different jobs he's had there. And now certainly he's not the only person, but he was relentless. And, you know, I find when I think about forming client relationships and how they relate to business, I mean, you worked with one of my colleagues, Vic Noble, you know, you got to find that relentless person, you know, who's going to stick their neck out and make people uncomfortable, you know, take certain amount of risk. And for us, you know, when I find those people, I, you know, want to do everything I can to make their star rise, because obviously we want to make their star rise and we get to, you know, go along for the ride. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to do. And I do think in this narrative of helping, not selling, engagement is medicine. Engagement is medicine. Medicine doesn't work without engagement. You just can't walk, mm-hmm. can't take a pill and hope to get a result. If you don't have that whole engagement value chain working. And we have clients who believe that, who operate on that. And, you know, that's like magical.
And for our listeners, Vic Noble worked at Shire and introduced Xiidra, which was just a blockbuster in eye care. And she was, as you say, relentless and passionate about the consumer, the experience, and making a difference in people's lives. And she was relentless. She was a force. She still is.
Your website is the front door of your business, but the way teams build and optimize it is simply broken. Stuck between inflexible templates and cumbersome code-dependent solutions, there's a better, faster way. Enter Webflow, a visual-first platform that empowers you to create freely. Experience a CMS where you can build dynamic content without code. Native localization that lets you translate your site in one click to reach global audiences. And third-party apps and integrations so you can build faster. Now you can ship web pages in weeks instead of months and save millions in development costs. These are the real results for companies like Orange Theory, Dropbox, and IDEO. Get started today at webflow.com. Webflow, more than a website builder.
We're getting to it toward the end of our discussion. I want to come back to this journey you've taken to CEO from being a creative person, a craft person, as you said. And it's the journey is a bit analogous, I think, to a CMO in a client company becoming a CEO. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen that often, but it does happen. So I want to ask you, as you made this transition to CEO, did you feel prepared? Were there skills that you felt you had to rapidly develop? If you had advice to someone who was moving from the creative area to CEO, what would those two or three major pieces of advice be?
David Kenny, who was the founder of Digitas, said to me years ago, I was lamenting about how I didn't have a Harvard MBA. And he said, Alex, you don't need an MBA. You just need a good finance guy.
There you shortcut that.
And honestly, that was so long ago. But I did have good finance guys and women, many, many female CFOs in my organization, too. Fantastic. And really, because I don't come out of a finance background at all, I really partner. Like I partner. They're my business partners. You know, they get to do a lot more with me because I don't keep them in a box. And I'm not trying to intimidate them with my acumen versus their acumen. You know, I really rely on their acumen. I really rely on their partnership. I've learned a lot about how to crack a P&L, by the way. But I learned it from them. And I learned it because I had good relationships with some fantastic people who were very patient with me and who, you know, suffered my ignorance with grace. And taught me a lot. And, you know, I used to always complain, and I still do sometimes, which is to be a CEO, like I have to learn your job. Like I have to learn the you know, some of the nuances of running the financial aspects of the business, but nobody has to learn my job. You know, who's going to learn my job? As a creative director, I always used to feel like, you know, who's going to get good at what I do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think CMOs might feel that way too, right? Yep. It's like, who cares about like all the magic that I have to make and pull out of my hat, you know, every other Wednesday. And so, but you know, if you can get that chip off your shoulder and really find a finance partner, an HR partner, and commercial partners who are generous and who you can build that team. You know, again, I go back to the ensemble. You know, my ensemble's different. My ensemble used to be an art director, a writer, a designer, a UX person, you know, and now that was years and years and years ago. And now it's a, you know, a CFO, a, you know, a chief growth officer, a chief talent officer, and we're our own, you know, band. And we try and have a good time.
Yeah. What's been your biggest aha in your 2 years as CEO, 2+ years?
You know, I think I knew this going in, but I just was proven out over and over again. I mean, you work for other people. Like, the higher up you get, the more people you work for. And you know, really trying to embrace what it means to be a servant leader. And the more people you're serving, you know, the more the gravity of that, you know, comes to the fore in terms of, you know, the stress of that. And, you know, the other thing that's obvious, but I learned over time, but clearly another female CEO said to me years ago, she said, you know, I don't know what's wrong with, you know, why more women aren't in the C-suite, because the only difference is, and she ran a huge pharmaceutical company, she said, the only difference is that you just have to make bigger decisions. Like, you make decisions every day. So you know that you're making decisions every day. You just have to make bigger decisions, and those decisions affect more people. But at the end of the day, it's about making decisions that you feel are your best decision you can make. And if you can do it at this level, you can aspire to do it at this level. It's not the domain of only certain people. It could be your domain too. And, you know, a couple of those dots kept connecting in my career that I kept saying, you know, I have a lot of criticism about how these organizations that I was working in ran. So I just kept putting my neck out to say, let me do that. How about if I do that? How about if I take that job? And followed my, I guess, my own frustration, you know, yeah, into saying, I'll take responsibility for that.
Now, we can't leave this podcast without saying something about the vaccine coming for COVID. And you have a pretty good seat looking at what's going on. I don't want to get your predictions, et cetera, et cetera. But I do want you to address, how do you think this process of coming to this vaccine at a time when the country is very vulnerable, the world is very vulnerable, how's this going to change the industry? Will we work in a different way? Will we value different things? Will we be seen differently?
Well, I certainly hope that, it's clearly that the world's hopes and prayers, honestly, are pinned to the pharmaceutical industry coming forward with, you know, viable vaccine and treatments that can put this crisis in the rearview mirror. It won't be the last time we have a pandemic either. So this has been, you know, an incredible trial by fire. But I do think that we'll regain some real credibility. And again, I think it's up to us in the industry to leverage that in a meaningful, authentic way, not in a hyperbolic way, but to bring the narrative of how this happened, you know, and make that more of a more culturally relevant and more even of a spectacle. You know, I'm very involved in the Galien Foundation, which is post the pre-Galien, which is really the commercial version of the Nobel Prize for Science. It focuses on the pharmaceutical industry. And we make a little film and they show it every year. We've been doing it. We've been sponsoring for many years. And it's about think back to your greatest discovery. And it shows little children, you know, think back further than that. And it ends with the day you decided to become a scientist. And I think that, you know, one of the real opportunities here is to bring that story to life while people are receptive. And beyond that, I would say, I'm sure the industry, and I, you know, I can't speak directly to it, although we do some clinical trial recruiting for sure, is the industry's the way this has been developed, how quickly, I think the industry surprised itself at how quickly they could mobilize and in concert, you know, in ways. I mean, there are partnerships that are forming, private and public partnerships, and to come together to rapidly develop solutions here that really COVID, we always say, you know, COVID accelerated a lot of the aspirations around digital development and different kinds of collaborations by 10 years. I mean, they had to do it. Necessity was the mother of invention, but the invention is now here and it's not going to go away. And I think it's going to serve, you know, humanity and for a long, long time.
Alex, I'll give you the last word. Anything you want to ask me before we sign off?
Well, how do you think, with the economy in shambles, how do you think the role of CMO is going to play out? Because, you know, marketing budgets get cut first usually. And what do you think the response has been, you know, to all of this economic downturn in other mm-hmm. industries?
I answer generally that CMOs are feeling more valued, more fulfilled, and more necessary than ever before. And the reason I say that, and this is industries that are challenged and those that have lots of tailwinds, they just feel that their employees and their consumers care more than ever about the purpose and the values of the company. And they want their company to not be on the sideline. They want them to be in the game on all sorts of issues, business issues, social issues. And a lot of that falls on the CMO because that's their domain. That's where they have skills. So I'm talking to a lot of CMOs these days. They're pretty energized. And I think they've stepped up in many ways. We've seen some great actions by so many companies. They're coming together through trade groups in a more forceful and powerful and coordinated way than I've seen. So I think you're going to see this role come out of this crisis stronger and more important in more companies. People call it different things, chief brand officer, EVP of marketing, whatever. But I think the person who is in many ways the voice of the customer and the employee, many of them are very into HR issues these days. So I think you're going to see these roles become bigger and more important for companies.
I think I've been seeing too that some of the RFPs we get are comms and marketing. And, you know, I know that sometimes there's tension between those two disciplines in the company, but the idea of, you know, the role of the corporate reputation and the brand reputation and having synonymous values around that and the role of the CMO makes sense to me.
Well, Alex, thank you for this. I wish you to be present with your family during the holidays and into 2021. It's been great reconnecting with you and having such a wonderfully thoughtful discussion.
Thank you, Jim. Happy Thanksgiving and happy holidays.
That was my conversation with Alex von Plato. There were so many highlights in this one. Alex talked about going to community college, then transferring to Temple. She talked about loving media and advertising early in her life. And then she talked about the transfer from being a creative person in an agency to a CEO. I also love her vision for healthcare. It's all about engagement and help and usefulness. Her holistic view of where the industry can go and is going in many cases. This was just a remarkable statement about the potential of science and the potential of healthcare to truly make this world a far better place, which they have done historically and more than ever need to do it now. That's it for this episode of the CMO Podcast. If you found this helpful and entertaining, I would be so grateful if you could share our show with your friends. And I would be super happy if you subscribed so you can be updated as we publish new episodes. And if you really want to help, leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The CMO Podcast is a Gallery Media Group original production.